desegregated the dealership from Dennis, but they were so affected that they desegregated the entire auto industry from San Francisco.
How many of you have ever heard of Dr. Bird? So,
not the one?
Nathaniel Burbridge.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't mention Nathaniel. So, you know, we wrote a full volume on history of African Americans in California, and we also do the Journal of Black Innovation, and we track the 50 most important African Americans in technology, which is a whole other topic of discussion, and we're combining it with our annual Healing the Diaspora session on April 8th that will give you a little bit more depth on some of these concepts. But getting back to King and Burbridge, Dr. King is influenced by San Francisco far more than we know. In the 1940s, his father would send him to San Francisco every summer. So between time he was 12 and 17, he would stay at 443 Scott Street in the Western Addition. And so he was influenced a great deal by his time here in San Francisco. And at the time that he was visiting, Dr. Carlton B. Goodlett was already the president of San Francisco NAACP in 1945. And when he was leading the marches in Selma, Montgomery, Dr. Burbridge was president of San Francisco NAACP. And once again, they got all these agreements before the passage of the Civil Rights Act because, in part, of the stature that these physicians and scientists and college professors had. Because clearly, if they were raising these issues, there was something that needed to be taken seriously. So we're gonna listen to a couple of interviews about Dr. Goodlett and Dr. Burbridge.
Black person hired in a tenured position at UC San Francisco, and he was so good in research on pharmacology, he was in line for the Nobel Prize. And he was a radical. And in fact, when they elected him head of the NAACP, the majority of the NAACP voted for him because he was light complexion and had two PhDs, and they figured he wouldn't rock the boat. Tom Fleming told me that Goodlett said, those Negroes made a big mistake when they elected Burbridge. And sure enough, I talked to a friend of Burbridge, Reginald Major. Reginald Major was a Marxist. His son had been in the Black Panther. And so when Burbridge became head of the NAACP, he called up this man and said, I want you to join the NAACP. And Reginald said, I wouldn't join those Negroes if you paid me. He said, you have to turn the NAACP out. Burbridge called him 2 weeks later and said, we're going to turn them out. And so Burbridge became our firm ally. And he led a major campaign on honor roll for jobs. He had also set up a medical system in Indonesia. This country overthrew the government of Indonesia and murdered a million Indonesians. But before that, the head of that government, Sukarno, came to San Francisco. The person he wanted to see was Nathaniel Burbridge. So the San Francisco Freedom Movement was a coalition of four NAACP, a group called the Ad Hoc Committee, which represented students at UC Berkeley, the Negro American Labor Council, and
designated me as a surrogate to attend two meetings in Africa. And this was in 1969. A meeting in Khartoum, Sudan, was to support the activities of the five liberation movements in sub-Saharan Africa. I think the reason Carlton didn't go was because he probably had four or five patients that he couldn't leave for the 2 weeks that he would be away. And he made a decision that he would just identify someone else to go in his place. So all of the arrangements that have been made for Carlton were transferred to me. And in 1969, I went to Khartoum, Sudan for a conference that lasted a full week. And it was designated to be the co-chair of the mobilization commission for that event. And the real honor, I had that kind of responsibility, but I participated in that number.
So that was Will Usry, and if you heard a lot of the coverage, Dr. King would have been 91 this week. But Will actually is 91. He's still around. And Will was also the national chair of CORE, and he was actually interviewed by Dr. King to be the executive director of SCLC and was part of the Birmingham. So we not only have the opportunity to see the close links between the San Francisco freedom movement, but also to hear it directly from people who were participants in it. But that's not really the beginning of our story. How many of you been to Los Angeles recently? Okay, I was just there this weekend. And about a block from City Hall on Spring Street is a block-long monument to a woman named Bridget Mason. And so, as it says here, she was a midwife. So, you know, it wasn't until the 1870s until California began licensing doctors. So, like many things, when women do something, it's not important. It's not worth being licensed and that sort of thing. And only when, you know, men decide to do it, they say, oh, we got to have some standards and some qualifications and that sort of thing. So for most of human history, birth is an occupation that women do. And so Bridget Mason, who came to California in 1853, along with a group of Mormons, became probably the most important midwife in Los Angeles, and became a major landowner, and there's a whole story about her. Well, let's look at some of the pioneers of black doctors in California. Dr. Ezra Johnson came in 1855. His office was right on Portson Square, about 50 yards from where the first American flag was planted. Dr. Monroe Majors was the first black to actually pass the California medical exam in 1888. He also started the first national organization of black doctors. But they didn't just come to be doctors. They actually were concerned about building communities. And part of our discussion is not just to give you some historical facts, but to really begin to look at an alternative approach to practicing medicine. So Dr. Richard Whitaker, built the Dunbar Hotel. Dr. John and Bates Sumville, they built the apartment building in 1927, then they built the Dunbar Hotel because the NAACP didn't have any place to meet, so they built the hotel to house the National Convention of the NAACP. Dr. Curtis King built the Rosetta Hospital, and it hosted the first interracial blood bank in 1942. And so Dr. Arthur Coleman, who I had the opportunity to know well, the Coleman Medical Center up on 3rd Street, they built in 1960, but in the late 1940s, he opened a bank, TransBay Savings. And if you look at most of the mortgages, one of the reasons why Baby Hunters Point had the highest home ownership rate in the city, because of mortgages that Dr. Coleman did. Back in LA, Dr. Peter Price Cobbs built the sanitarium, and then his son would also become a doctor, and he wrote about Black Rage. Dr. Shelby Robinson was a woman who came from Atlanta to be an OBGYN. In 1932. And Dr. Ruth Temple started Southeast Los Angeles Community Health Center, which was the first of its kind in the nation. Dr. Wesley Johnson had a chance to talk to his daughter this morning. He opened 3 pharmacies in San Francisco. He's one of the first Black graduates of USC School of Pharmacy. And so, but as we alluded earlier, many of these doctors were more known for what they did outside the clinic than what they did. Byron Lumford was a pharmacist and passed the Fair Housing Act in 1963. We're still fighting about fair housing, right? 1963, so this was 2 years before Selma passed the Fair Housing Act in California. Dr. Goodlett ran for governor in 1966, against Ronald Reagan and Pat Brown. Dr. Dan Collins, some of you know his son, Chuck Collins, became a member of the State Board of Education. Dr. Loretta Goosby was one of the first Black members of the San Francisco Board of Education. Dr. Henry Lucas was a power in Republican politics. He also started something called PACT. And from 1964 up to present, PACT helped 40,000 Black students get into college. And so this is the kind of legacy and impact that we've been looking at for a Black doctor. And then this weekend I was down at Charles Street University of Medicine and Science. They've had 7,000 graduates in the last 50 years. So clearly, these these doctors have been coming from a tradition of centuries of practice of medicine. I'm the history advisor to the Songhai people, and I was able to trace my family to a chemistry professor at the University of San Corray in the 1300s. And so 75% of today's African Americans come from Songhai. Yeah. But who knows what Songhai is?
Yeah.
Okay. Songhai Empire covered 10 current African countries. It was 2.5 times the size of the United States. And so the universities at Timbuktu, Gao, Janae, San Corray were regarded as the best in the world. So people came from Arabia, from Europe, from Asia to study. So one of the reasons why Africans from this part of West Africa were sought after and actually flourished in what became the United States was because they brought with them these skills and technology of what was considered one of the most advanced areas of the world. And so that's something we often lose in what we call the Jamestown paradigm, because many of us think that Black history started in 1619. 1619 is the beginning of Black people in the United States. That date would be 1508. But in Shanghai, one of the things that we were able to do about 5 years ago was to stop a group of invaders from overrunning Timbuktu and Gao. And we saved hundreds of thousands of what are called the Shanghai manuscripts. So the story of those universities is in writing, and they've been protected by the people of that region for centuries as various waves of invaders have come by. And we just started to have UNESCO to scan those so it can be preserved into the future. And at that point, these folks came down and tried to burn some of those shrines down. But within those manuscripts is a whole history of all kinds of scientific disciplines. So the Africans who came to America brought with them centuries of experience in medicine. And so it's important as we start thinking about treatments and disparities and things like that to realize that we're not dealing with objects. We're dealing with people who have a tradition of healing themselves. And so, as we look at the people that we've talked about before, one thing is very clear is that they saw medicine as treating the environment that the people lived in. So when Dr. Carlton Goodwin came in the 1930s, he had a medical degree from Meharry, then he got a PhD from UC Berkeley in psychology. One of the first things he did was became president of San Francisco NAACP. Now most people would say, oh, I got a medical degree, I got a psychology degree, I'm busy. Right? But he also bought a newspaper, San Francisco Sun Reporter, right? Along with Dr. Dan Collins. So San Francisco Sun Reporter, which 75 years old this year, was started by two doctors. So all their actions showed them that they understood that the disease that most black folks had was racism. There are different manifestations of it. You know, some folks had heart disease, some folks had cancer, some folks had cirrhosis of the liver. But the disease was racism. And so what you see in these doctors was that they said, well, if I want to take care of my patients, I need to address the root cause of what's happening in their lives. So Dr. Somerville, a dentist, 1927. He builds the finest apartment building in Los Angeles for blacks to live in, because he understood people couldn't be healthy unless they had a place to live. Then he builds the hotel for the NAACP to come. These are not things that doctors have to do, but they understood that if the community was going to be healthy, that they needed to take the initiative and do that. So it's a different model than the model that is so prevalent right now in medicine. When I was in LA, I was talking to David Carlisle this weekend, reflecting on the fact that and including here, that the greatest medical research institutions in the country are either within or adjacent to the areas with the greatest health disparities. Columbia, University of Chicago, Johns Hopkins, UC San Francisco. And we need to start asking the question, wait a minute, with all these buildings going up and, you know, all this technology, why is it that Bayview Hunters Point has third world health results? And so part of what we began to look at as part of the California African American Freedom Trail is to take a big data approach to Black history, as opposed to just, oh, this event happened then. How do we aggregate all of this experience into something that's meaningful to the future? And so where we come down is that probably the most important intervention we can make to bounce back Black population in San Francisco or Los Angeles or Chicago or Brooklyn is increase the number of Black members. Because when we look at the history, the people who started things, the people who funded things, the people who supplied the leadership, were the doctors. And we built 7 or 8 new hospitals in San Francisco in the last 10 years, depending on the definition. And only 1.7% of the doctors in San Francisco are Black. And now if Drew has graduated 7,000 doctors, most of them Black, how do we only have 70 Black doctors in San Francisco? So these are some interventions that we can, you know, realistically begin to undertake. And as my bio mentioned, we've started to look at the infrastructure of economic justice, because when you have this big data approach to Black history, you start thinking, well, wait, it's not about disparities. This is a term I heard in the weekend about asset mapping. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what are our strengths? What are our advantages? What are our competitive advantages? And how do we take advantage of those? So the proposal that we are about to submit to the Port Commission is to create the Dr. T. Nathaniel Burbridge Center for Inclusive Innovation. And its goal will be to attract Black doctors from HBCU schools of medicine, and there are also 180 medical schools in Africa, 60 in the Caribbean, and commercialize their research. If you remember the first slide, Dr. Ted Love just did an IPO for $250 million for one drug to treat sickle cell anemia. Dr. Ernest Bates has been public for 30 years with, you know, American Shared Hospital Services. So we've known how to generate large enterprises, generate wealth for a long time, but we just have not focused on it. And so with the Burbridge Center, we want to take the advantages of UCSF and Stanford and to attract people who would not have the opportunity to participate in those fields and help them create commercial opportunities from the disparities that we find. We got an exposure to some of these opportunities sort of serendipitously about 5 years ago. A group of Black doctors in San Pablo contacted me through Paul Cobb, who's the publisher of the Open Post, and said, we need to save our hospital. And I'm thinking,
right up to me. I didn't like to go to the hospital, right? So I know nothing about hospitals, right? But I guess it's sort of my lot in life. Nobody ever calls me and say, hey, let's go have a drink, let's go. People call me and say, well, the fate of the world depends on you doing something in the next 10 minutes, and you gotta stop whatever you're doing and do this. Those kind of calls I get. So when somebody said, okay, we need you to save this hospital, I said, okay. So I was intrigued by the fact that they thought I could do it. So we went out, and the hospital council had said, there's no way you can save this hospital. Kaiser Permanente said, no way you can save the hospital. Everybody, you know, it's got closed, right? So I go out, and we see that this hospital had hosted the largest mass casualty event in history when the Chevron refinery burned and 14,000 people had to go to the hospital. So in my naivete, I'm saying, well, if the hospital in here, where are those people gonna go? So my thinking is, well, you gotta keep the hospital because you got five refineries. So then we realized that most of the people were coming for emergency visits, and most of the visits didn't require emergency attention. The other thing we realized was that the people who were coming were not insured, although it's not required for everybody to be insured. And the state of California had given hospitals money to sign people up for insurance. They had refused the money. So clearly there was a fix in to close the hospital. And of course, the lobbyist for Chevron was the chairman of the hospital. So basically, Chevron wanted to close the hospital and get rid of this registry of patients. So we said, well, actually, it's the registry. That's the most valuable thing. If you keep the registry of these people who have, you know, mutations that nobody else has in the world, you don't need to charge them anything. And then we said, well, since pollution is the biggest problem there, why don't we reduce pollution? So we came up with the idea to create the first carbon neutral hospital in the country. So we took to Wall Street and said, okay, we want to do first carbon neutral hospital in the country. And they said, oh, $50 million, no problem. Right. Then we came back to Contra Costa County and said, okay, we got the money to rebuild the hospital, buy, and all that sort of thing. And they were like, wait a minute. we weren't trying to keep this hospital open. this isn't part of the script here. Black folks aren't supposed to be able to do stuff like that. Mm. And so we presented it, and the people who were hired to shut the hospital down, they supported our proposal. The Chevron lobbyists supported our proposal. But the supervisor who was, you know, in the pocket of the casino said, nah, I've already done a deal with the casino to shut the hospital down and build a hotel for the casino. So they just knocked the hospital down. You got 250,000 people with no hospital. And to make matters worse, Alta Bates, which was the next nearest hospital, getting ready to close that too. Mm-hmm. So you got a whole sector of the East Bay that's going without health care. So this is a fundamentally different approach than these doctors we've talked about. You know, we saw in LA, three different black doctors built hospitals in the 1920s. You know, they didn't say, oh, you know, I can make more money by doing tests and that sort of thing. These are the facilities that I need to build. Dr. Coleman, Wesley Johnson, they built the Coleman Medical Center up on 3rd Street. You know, so they made the investment in the facilities and the capabilities to do this. About 3 years ago, there was a cardiologist on Crenshaw down in Los Angeles, and he wanted to have his own EKG so he didn't have to send the women in the neighborhood down to the hospital. So the women went in their savings and bought him an EKG. Just for their own convenience and for the convenience of the neighborhood. So there is a different approach to medicine. And if we're really serious about dealing with health disparities, we will begin to really study the legacies of these doctors. I met Dr. Goodlett when I was 17, and I was a freshman at Howard University, and he was responsible for starting the School of Communication at Howard University. So I decided to go into journalism. And then when I went to grad school in Carolina, he was the advisor for our Black Press Institute. And then he actually recommended me for my first job as an editor. So it was 5 years that I knew him before I realized he was a doctor, because I knew how to do that function. And then once I actually moved out to San Francisco, realized, I mean, this man was doing house calls. And we know him as the president of the National Newspaper Publishers Association, dealing with advertisers and media and public and all. This man is practicing medicine. And as Will Usry said, the reason that Will wound up as president of, co-chair of the mobilization for the liberation of Southern Africa was because Dr. Goodlett had some patients he had to take care of. Otherwise, Dr. Goodlett would have been that person. So, to put that in context, in the 70s when I was still in college, we demonstrated about just about something every week at Howard University. One of our favorite topics was liberation of Africa. Right? That was kind of easy. It was, South Africa, Mozambique, Angola were still colonies. So it didn't seem likely that that would change. And so the primary mechanism for making that happen was the Mobilization Committee for Liberation of Southern Africa. So to see that somebody from San Francisco was one of the leaders of that is pretty astounding to me in hindsight, because I remember the mobilization. It's like, wait a minute, Dr. Goodlett, either directly or indirectly, is orchestrating Nelson Mandela, Mugabe, all these folks to free Southern Africa, and running for governor of California and putting out a newspaper. That's the kind of impact that we're talking about in terms of African American doctors and them understanding the nature of how to effectively treat what ails their patients. So at that point, I will pause for questions. And as I mentioned, it's a collaboration. Probably some of you have some experiences with African American physicians. Have to notice that we walk down the Dr. Tabas walkway as we enter this building. So you've had folks like Dr. Gene Washington and the current provost, Andre Campbell, who have been doing great things here at UCSF. So I'm sure other people have some experiences they want to share. But with that, let's take some questions.
You spoke about some tour you're doing between now and March.
Mm-hmm.
Can you speak more about that?
Sure. The California African American Freedom Trail.
Just so that everybody can hear you. We've got people
asked about the tour. He mentioned he was doing a tour between now and March, and I wanted to know a little bit more about that.
Okay. So California African American Freedom Trail is our mapping of 6,000 sites around the state. As I mentioned back in 1991, after the Rodney King beating, I wrote Our Roots Run Deep, the Black Experience in California, which is 4 volumes. And so normally historians write a book, and that's pretty much it. You just have to go read it. But I began to start thinking about where do these things actually happen. And one of the reasons why people didn't know about these things is that the places where it happened weren't recognized. So I spent about 20 years going to the State Historical Resources Commission and city planning commissions and that sort of thing, saying we need to actually have a system of marking Black historic sites. So in 2017, we did the final presentation to the American Historical Association that got endorsed by the State Historical Resources Commission. So we're now building a network of 6,000 sites around the state. And so what we've done since really the last 25 years in San Francisco is give tours, because the information is so amazing that I could talk to her, I was blue in the face, but you actually just have to show people. Mm-hmm. So I could say, well, you know, California named for a Black woman. But in my book, I have a 5-part lesson plan just to get people to the point where I can even introduce that topic, right? And so, and one of the things we do is we actually take people to the Mark Hopkins Hotel. You see the 9-foot mural of Queen Calafia, you know, not on Nob Hill, or you can see the mural of Queen Calafia in the state capitol. Because you wouldn't believe it if I said it. So that's the genesis of the tours. But we've kind of regularized it the last 5 years with San Francisco Travel. So on Fridays, beginning the 31st at 1 o'clock, we'll be doing our land tour. And you can register for it at queencalifornia.com. And then on Saturdays, beginning February 1st, we just started a new sequence on Red, White, Blue, where we look at the Black maritime experience in the San Francisco Bay, because the man who found the port of San Francisco, in fact, in the narrative where the Spanish located the harbor, it says the sailor named El Negro was the first to see it. And so the first person to actually commercialize the port was a captain named William Alexander Rydersdorf. And so there are 5 great captains during the 19th century that we talk about on the tour, and we give an hour-long audio tour of Black maritime history. And so that's on the 1st, 8th, 15th, 22nd, and 29th at 11:15. And you can register for the sea cruise at redandwhitefleet.com and just click on the 11:15 cruise on Saturdays. Other questions?
I have a question. I would just like to say that if you have...
She actually took
I've taken the tour, and I bought the books. And if you have not taken the tour, you gotta do it. It's eye-opening, and what's astounding is that there's all of this Black history hidden in plain sight.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an amazing experience. Wear comfortable shoes. Wear comfortable shoes, because it's a walk. But get the books. The books are wonderful. I mean, they're very educational. Each one's about this big, and they're chock full of information.
One more question? You also did compliments, too.
Well, you mentioned that that someone tried to burn the manuscripts and the sites around in Mali. Can you tell me who that was?
When Gaddafi was overthrown, there were all kinds, it was basically a civil war in Libya. And so various groups of mercenaries were involved, and then there were troops from NATO came in and pushed them out. When they got pushed out, they went south into Chad and Mali and that sort of thing, and basically began wreaking havoc. And so we actually had to go to Washington back during the Obama administration and say, well, look, y'all created this mess, y'all need to clean it up. And so the French actually went in and secured the area. We were able to move a lot of materials to a safer place. But it's still very dicey because you have all kinds of groups who are you have heard of Boko Haram in Nigeria, so that whole area is in turmoil. But you know, the immediate threat we were able to deal with, and you know, the Amu Sanghai, Dr. Baigo, he's direct descendant of Askia Muhammad, and so this lineage goes back 800 years. And so, you know, with all the attention you've seen to the royal family and their various, you know, permutations, this gentleman is the person to whom most of our ancestors consider royalty, you know, in the same length of time. A much larger area, and most people don't know about him. So we try to first preserve what's already there, and then to the extent it's possible to make more people aware of him. There was also another video we were going to show. Because one of the things that we did was to
a little rain will fall, the sun will shine, and you can look for your rainbows and hummingbirds.
So 10 years ago, we were we got a grant to figure out, well, how do you get more Black youth to go into medicine. So we did something called Contrarian Progress. And it was the origin for our reunion network.
So this is the very first thing that happened. You actually do whatever it takes to get interested
in medicine. So this is the first day we picked them up in a van. We took them to the Global AIDS Conference. So we threw them right into the middle of it.
Thank you.
there's another. We have Dr. Lisa White. Part of what we did, we actually hired these students as public health investigators.
Dr. Lisa White is a professor of geology and is chair of the geoscience department. Dr. White has been working at SF State ever since 1990. She has her PhD in earth science from the University of California at Santa Cruz in 1989. Dr. White is principal investigator of the 5-year grant recently awarded to the SFSU geoscience department.
Well, it's really wonderful to be here. Greetings, future doctors and public investigators, health investigators. I'm really interested in what the Earth was like millions of years ago, because it helps us understand everything from, you know, why we have salt in some parts of the ocean today, and, you know, why we might have oil in another part, or why certain environments are the way they are. Understand this concept of salinity, which is how much salt, sodium, chloride, and other ions might be dissolved in seawater. Just the structure of salt itself, you know, these large chloride ions and then the sodium. And when they pack together, they actually form a pretty neat little cube. So if you look at salt under a microscope, little squares. So.
Na is a gas.
Au is gold.
At is helium. And A is magnesium.
So animals that live in the sea deal with salt. So you all know a bit about how we metabolize, or how we don't metabolize, the salt that surrounds them.
You mentioned that something that was important in the past when Black doctors were in California, they built community.
Yes,
they still do. I'm curious about how do you then leverage your California Freedom Trail tour to kind of like market out to people who, Black people specifically, who don't live here, as well as reach and connect to Black people who do live here, who may be professionals or upper middle class, wealthy Black people, but don't have that connection to community, because they don't see people who look like them. Most people who visit say, well, I didn't see any Black people in San Francisco. Let's do erasure, because we are here, which is small little pocket, but we're here. I'm interested in like, how do you like spread the wave and like get people to connect to community, leveraging your tour and connecting with that like Black professional, Black wealthy class, so that they're invested back in the community?
Excellent question, and that basically is why we're creating the Burbage Center. You need a place. You know, so you gotta have a place to start. And so our first book, when I was originally from Virginia, which is mostly Black, was the Illustrated National Guide to Black Households. We looked at the 1980s census, and we looked at 150 characteristics across 150 countries. So a couple of years ago, I needed to turn that book digital so it could be replicated, which meant I had to go over and do all the work again.
Can you repeat the name of the book?
Illustrated National Guide to Black Household. But I realized, well, if I gotta go to all that trouble, why don't I see what happened in those communities in the 40 years since then? So the new book I did is called Come to the Water, African Americans from 1980 to 1920. Because what was fascinating was to see how in 1980, there was a 95% chance that an African American lived on a block that was 100% black across the country. There was only one metropolitan area in the country where that wasn't true, and that was the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. Now, if you go back to those same places in DC or New York or Atlanta, no black people live on our blocks at all, mm-hmm. Right? But I had the benefit of having been a journalist during that whole time. So I could not only look at the data, but I could remember specific things that I had written about at specific times and say, oh, this is what happened because this happened and that sort of thing. So this problem is a problem in every metropolitan area in the country. And so we created something called Blackwell 2020, which is a meeting we have every month in DC, where we're looking at how do we close the capital leakage gap. African Americans are 13% of the population, but we get 6% of income. So we've gone from 3/5 of a person in the Constitution to 43% of a person today. We actually went back while going forward. So the difference between that and actually achieving, say, 10% is $800 billion a year. And so we've come up with a national strategy on how to do that. And one of the reasons we do National Black Business Month is to show people 31 ways, 31 days, how to find black businesses in specific industries, and so a big part of that is cultural heritage tourism, because one of the best ways for us to hold on to our communities is to commercialize heritage from other communities. Mm-hmm. So the Freedom Trail, with 6,000 sites, there are 1,600 black business campuses going into the day. And they all leave thinking, I didn't see the black people, right? Unless I happen to catch them and give them a brochure at the visitor center, which is now easier because we just put it in the Moscone Center and I can just go down there and hang out when I have free time. But a lot of it is just spreading the word.
Yeah.
And so the site, KingCalifiaMovie.com, that has the tools. And we just have to let people know that the sources are available and that the biggest thing we can do for our own health is to do what we people did in the 1920s and 1930s, which is invest in our community. And so it's really not rocket science. But what Bernard Kinsey talks about is the myth of absence. Because we don't hear about ourselves in the news, we're not reported, we think nothing's going on. And there's a lot going on. And we just need to use our own individual networks to spread those things that are effective. Because if they could build three black hospitals in LA in the 1920s. Why can't we build one in Contra Costa County? And despite the out-migration in San Francisco, there are still 750,000 black folks in Northern California. We're $15 billion a year of income. And so the Burbridge Center is intended to be the economic center for those people, where they can make money. And that's the mistake we make in our communities. We don't create economic magnet.
Mm-hmm.
So unless you have a source of employment, just look at Mission Bay. Mission Bay was nothing 5 years ago. I mean, people are complaining about homeless. It's like, wait a minute, that's all that was here 5 years ago. Y'all are intruding on their space, right?
Right. Okay.
So, but what do they do first? Creating jobs. The Stem Cell Institute. This is one of the reasons why we took the kids to Stem Cell Institute. This is what creates jobs in San Francisco. All right? You said you either go on work in healthcare, or you're going to be raw material. You can choose which one it is. Right? So the Stem Cell Institute created all of this around. And then the housing came, then the retail came, the warriors came, but it all started with jobs. And that's what we don't do in black communities. And healthcare is the one industry that we can do anywhere because we all have problems with health disparities. And there are business opportunities from it. So that is literally the economic solution for every black community is to focus on healthcare entrepreneurship.
Where can we find your books?
QueenCaliphiaMovie.com and also CaliforniaBlackHistory.com.
Can you give a little more information on the Burbage Center? I'm not really familiar with it.
We hadn't built it yet, but we're doing the RFP for it. And there are 9 historic piers that the port is putting out for bid. The history of the port is that most people who worked on the port were black. But if you go down in Embarcadero now, you don't see any black people. Right? So because it is a historic site, it has to be consistent with the history. And the case you're making to the port is that, okay, there's got to, you know, the port has been the economic engine for the black middle class in San Francisco, people working as longshoremen, you know, all kinds of other jobs. So there should be an economic engine for the black community on the port. The Burbage Center will be contemplated as a research center where we attract commercialization from historical black colleges and universities and their schools of medicine and connect with the industries here. And we also would include the Sergeant Johnson National Museum of Art. So there is no National Museum of African American Art, and we have the African American History Museum on the ball. But all the other museums are history museums. We don't have a museum specifically dedicated to art. So as she mentioned, that's intended to create the kind of cultural magnet that would draw people to the area so people would get off cruise ship, come to the Sergeant Johnson, you know, connect with black wineries, you know, things. So a combination of economic and cultural uses. And so we developed a team of some of the top black developers and architects from around the country. We're working on the proposal right now.
I have a question here, and then I think this gentleman's next.
Before Bernard Tyson died, the African American CEO of Kaiser,
yes.
I understand that they were building apartment buildings for low-income persons because they recognized if we don't do something about the neighborhood, the environment, you know, we're going to still, you know, we're not really doing anything. I don't know if this is still part of Kaiser's initiative.
Yes.
But I'm just curious when you talk about San Pablo, how did Kaiser pull that off, and why can't other hospitals do something like that in terms of what made it economically attractive?
Well, what was ironic about it was that the first Kaiser was started in Richmond, right? So it's like, this is the home managed care. And we're not going to serve these people who, among other things, built the ships that saved this country in World War II. So even if it didn't make money, we owed it to it, right? Like I said, the conventional wisdom was that you couldn't make money with Medicare, Medicaid-dependent hospital. And so you're not only seeing closures there, but seeing closures
all across the South. So large portions of the Black Belt had no hospital. And because the states wouldn't approve the Medicaid expansion. So this is a national problem in terms of the infrastructure for people to become healthy. It's closing. You know? So Kaiser is making an investment in housing and doing a number of other things. It's opening a new medical school down in Southern California that they named for Mr. Tyson. So he was definitely a breath of fresh air in terms of understanding the link between, you know, people and healthcare. Because as we're seeing with the coronavirus, you know, and it's the World Health Organization says everybody should have universal health care. So there's no reason we're even having this debate in the United States. This is global. But unless everybody has health care, nobody has it.
Anthony Amaro, Center for Science Education Outreach. Really appreciate the topic shared today. Lots of good information, especially with Black History Month right around the corner. And the pieces that really stood out to me is how the doctors were moving beyond what they were maybe trained in to impact the community and build within the community. And then also the points around like the economy. And I wonder, how has the economy potentially shifted the way in which Black doctors are engaging in the community? Because at this current time, it's probably difficult for Black physicians, and my partner is a physician and she is Black, to afford a home here in San Francisco, let alone build a hospital or a hotel. Like, how has the local economy impacted the way in which Black doctors are investing into the local community?
Well, one of the changes is that in this era that we've been talking about, they had to depend on the Black community because they didn't have hospital privileges until the mid-60s. So they had no incentive to take you to a hospital. That treats you where you work. And they had to keep you from getting sick. So that's part of why you had a different model. But we're seeing the same phenomenon among lawyers. You know, for instance, you can't find a civil rights lawyer now. Because if you go to court, the Black lawyers are working for the firm that's defending the corporation. Because once they get out of law school and got the bills and that sort of thing, they have to take the job that's going to, you know, pay them the most money. So this is a phenomenon that we've seen across many professions where the people, even though we've had an increase in Black professionals, they're working in a lot of other places and they're living close to the places where they work, so they're not as connected to the community as they have been, which underscores why we need something like the Burbage Center, so that even people who are, you know, only have a little bit of time to give, at least have one place. When Price Cobbs died, his memorial service was at the Commonwealth Club. So basically every Black CEO in the country was in one room. So KKK could have just taken out a whole bunch of folks in one. But what everybody was realizing is, why can't we do this more often? And so when I was editor of the San Jose Business Journal in 1987, 1989. I'm coming from Richmond, Virginia, where most of the population was Black. I come to San Jose, and I was in San Jose like 10 days before I saw another Black person. So we started something called the Black Executive Forum, which actually led to things like 100 Black Men, that sort of thing. And you couldn't get in the room unless you had a budget of $10 million. And we had 200 people show up. And they all thought they were the only one. And so it's really about creating mechanisms so that people are able to sort of magnify whatever they're able to give, as long as they're able to find other people with common cause. And so the event we're doing on January 8th, with the 50 most important African Americans in technology, is something we've done for the last 19 years. And it's about finding people. For instance, the head of Defense Logistics Agency, so the basically biggest body in the world, black three-star general, the head of National Institute of Health on Diabetes, National Institute of Health on Heart and Lung, are both black. And so people don't know that. And so it's about bringing those people together in a room and letting them know it's like, you know, I'm not spending all day on black issues, but 3-4 times a year, I can do something that makes a difference if I know people who I can connect with. And so it's about making those connections so that we can make an impact and focusing on, you know, the things. So let's say we increase the number of black doctors in San Francisco from 70 to 500. And we just did that. What we would notice is that they got families, they go to churches, they go to the barbershop, you know. So the ripple effect of that is what actually creates the kind of change that we want. Because the other thing about doctors is that they're the people who most likely be able to afford living. You know. So we have to be a combination of realistic and take advantage of opportunities and put them in a situation where they are exploiting their expertise to become entrepreneurs as opposed to just employees. I think that's the trajectory we have to put them on. It's like, okay, if you're doing research, you know, come up with, you know, because the gentleman on the cover of this month's Journal of Black Innovation, Freddie Figures, 30 years old, just invented a glucose monitor. $62 million company, right? So there are many opportunities to leverage experience, and we just have to give people the tools to expand the repertoire.
Question. I love this, by the way, thank you. One of the questions that I had was, I was running the Black Infant Child Program in LA County, and one of the biggest things that we saw was that African-American mommies, the objective was to reduce the infant and maternal mortality. What we saw was lack of African-American medical doctors right on. One of the questions that I had for you, though, that seems such a long-term sustainable solution. However, I would love to know the data in the 1920s when we had the African-American medical doctors and compared to the data today. Do you see the difference, and what was the difference in maternal as well as infant mortality? As we saw the data in the civil rights movement time, the disparities were lower than they are today. So I see the long-term objective with creating or promoting more African-American doctors. However, is that even doable in approaching the urgent and the immense need of prohibiting infant mortality in today's America?
Well, one approach is that, as you see in California history and you know, the presentation, everything happens in San Francisco is magnified. So if we have a shortage of black doctors, it's more important to have black doctors in San Francisco because they're going to impact people all over the world. So, you know, Drew has graduated 7,000 black doctors. Where'd they go? Right, we got 70 here in the city right now. So there are ways to attract. And our center is designed to bring people in for short periods of time so that they can go back to other places, but to just kind of have a rotation of people coming through here so that we both expand, you know, the importance of this area, but we also spread to other communities. So, but part of what we saw with the kids is that
within 6 weeks' time, you couldn't convince them that they weren't doctors. So with them meeting doctors and finding out from the radiologist, okay, it's gonna take 13 years for you to get where I am. You know, but if they're starting when they're in the sixth grade, you know, that's the time to reach them. And so, we need to open, there are 5 medical schools in Haiti. African-American, 43 million, we only have 4. Cuba has 9, 181 in Africa. So we need at least 10 more medical schools at HBCUs in order to, because black population is now 43 million, is going to grow to 75 million by 2050. So literally, we need to have the same emphasis on creating doctors that we have on creating basketball players. Charles Barkley and Kenny Smith and Shaq were saying Monday night, we don't give money to people to be athletes. We give money to people to be doctors. They're athletes. And they're saying there's only 5,000 people who ever played in the NBA. You know, so your chances of being a doctor are far greater than being an NBA player. And so the athletes are saying we need more doctors. And so those are the kind of messages that we need to send out.
I want to ask a question about the traditional black colleges, but you did say that the last time I looked, the traditional black colleges were, or the traditional black medical colleges were, didn't have a large percentage of black students as they had in the past. Is that still happening? Are the numbers decreasing?
Depends on the campus, but we're not sending them out of K-12. So people are coming in from overseas, and you know, if you can get into medical school anywhere in the United States, doesn't matter if it's an HBCU. So, but that's something that we can, you know, deal with in terms of creating more students who are ready. You know, only 0.9% of black students, high school students, take calculus. Only 12% take algebra. So one of the reasons we created Reunion was to bring the courses from HBCUs into K-12 class, because the test scores don't tell us anything. They never even had a class.
Are you saying that the reason that the numbers of black students are going down in traditional HBCU
schools? In medicine.
In medical schools is because the African-American students are not applying because they don't have the qualifications? Is that what you're saying?
They're not getting out of high school.
They're definitely not in the STEM
program. Yes. I mean, if you haven't had calculus, you know, that rules out 90% of occupations.
Because I was under the impression that they were competing with other students who were wanting to come into the school, and on that basis, the other students being better prepared, they were not able to.
No.
They're not even showing up to play the game.
Yeah. They're not even showing up to play the game.
No.
Okay.
I mean the campuses are being forced to admit people just so they can stay open.
I understand.
Yeah, there was a study done in the Bay Area 5 years ago or so where African American and Latino students were having to take algebra twice. So that gets them off of the college track for the STEM career.
Yeah, the AD, yeah. Right? AD, you can't even get into UC Berkeley unless you've done the AG. Like I said, last time I looked at the civil rights report at the Department of Education, there were only 100 black students in all 9 counties that took calculus.
Right.
I mean, San Francisco Unified, they had like 12. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Oakland was the leader at 25.
You know, so we're not even beginning to produce the number of kids, but they have the talent. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're getting able to say. You just throw them in the water and it's like, you do stuff. It's like, oh, we do trigonometry every time you cross the street.
I just have a comment. So this discussion could appear to be saying that Black students can't do it.
No.
But I have a 50-year-old son who, in San Francisco, in the public schools, transferred to high school and went to his math class and opened the door, and the teacher said, "You're in the wrong class." Mm-hmm. And he said, "Wait a minute, isn't this room 203? She said, "You're in the wrong class."
Right.
And he asked again, and when she said the third time, "You're in the wrong class," he got the message. He will not be in those advanced math classes.
That's right. That's
so,
right.
You know, I just, for people who don't understand, this is what happens to Black students.
Yeah,
I just want to be sure you know.
Yeah,
it's not that we're choosing not to do that.
Not
and it's not that we don't have the ability. It's that we don't get the opportunity because we are actively blocked from doing it.
And that's one reason why we created Reunion, because by putting the classes online, that removes that barrier, and the best teachers of Black students are at the HBCUs, so they have the ability to teach math and science in ways that they wouldn't get in the classroom. So that was sort of our proof of concept from doing Fraternal Progress. So we said, well, what do you have to do that? And it takes 6 weeks to kind of break down, you know, the learning challenges and the things that have been put in people's head. And once they do that, then, you know, you just have to step out of the way and let them fly. So we say, okay, well, we put this on video, then we can scale that up to be across the country. So as you see on the flyer, we've got, you know, our season starts March 5th, and we've got three fantastic series on the 13, 14, 15th Amendment. So please share that with all your friends around the country.
We're going to take the last three questions. One, two, and there was three.
Well, this is not so much a question, but just to add a little bit to this, you know, there were more Black students in medical school in the 70s because of affirmative action. And I don't know if you guys know this history, but here at UCSF, it was the janitors and the people who worked here who said, "You guys have to take more Black students." And I'm an MD, I'm a Black MD. I graduated in 1977. My husband was also in the class. He's a GI doc in Oakland. We both worked all our lives in, you know, practices in Oakland. My husband went into practice with a San Francisco native, Zealous Wiley. I don't know whether any of you guys know him. And he was Black. They had three Black doctors in practice. But you have to understand that when we came out in 1980, I came out because I'm a general internist, they had just desegregated the hospitals.
No way.
You know? So, Alta Bates was the white hospital, Herrick was the Black hospital. When I joined a Black doctor, when Robert Scott, somebody may know him, when I first came out, and Bob told me, "Don't bother to get privileges at Peralta, because I'm still boycotting them, because, you know, they were segregated right up to that point." So, Providence was the Black hospital, Merritt was the white hospital. We're talking about a transition from segregation, that's what Carlton Goodlett was working with, to integration. And I think, you know, you mentioned Jean Washington briefly, you know, Michael Drake, who is he's the president of Ohio State now, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he's a big deal. Yeah. There are a lot of people who came out in my generation who are doing things. Bernard Tyson was 60, but we were kind of less visible because of integration. Mm-hmm. We're working in settings that are mostly white, even if you, like I worked at a clinic in Berkeley for a while. I was the only black doctor there. At Kaiser, when I was there, out of 80 internists, I think there were five of us who were black. But, so you may not see us in the same way, and we're not starting hospitals, that's true. but I mean, what's sad to me is that the numbers have gone down. I mean, they went up, and then they went down. And I think the Bakke decision, you know, where that was the end of affirmative action, California, and it was chilling. Not just, it discouraged a lot of people, even if they could have applied. You know, the applications to the University of California went down.
We had no applications.
So anyway, I just wanted to add those little things, but enjoy your presentation.
And on February 5th, we're going to be announcing a repeal Prop 209 campaign that will be introduced in the legislature. So, like I said, that is one thing that has had a major dampening effect, and probably thousands of black folks didn't go to medical school over the last 22 years who would have without that.
Yeah, the last word.
Okay. I really appreciate this presentation.
Thank you.
And it's really invaluable historical information. I'm an HBCU graduate, a medical physician here in the Bay Area, mm-hmm. and a member of Sinclair Miller mm-hmm. and the NMA.
Yeah.
And one of the things that that I think is really important is that also I don't think that young physicians organize as much. Mm-hmm. So I had mentors that talked about meetings that they would have mm-hmm. in the 70s and 80s and how they all knew each other
yeah.
and got together.
Yeah.
And I don't think that exists in the same way.
Yeah.
A lot of people are the only provider at their site mm-hmm. just to survive. And so I think when you talk about putting together initiatives, pulling resources, whether it's brain power or financial resources, I think one of the first steps is getting young physicians together.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's like a generational gap right now
yeah.
where, you know, one of my mentors used to say, you guys are gonna make me get my, she was joking of course, but my fatigues and my picket signs out again because you're not coming together in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I mean, I don't know how many young physicians are in this room, but that.
Well, and like I said, I mean, it mm-hmm. it takes infrastructure. I mean, you go down Geary Street, you see like four blocks. That the only thing that building can be is Japantown, right? And there are not that many Japanese who live in that community anymore, but there's a place
mm-hmm.
where everybody who thinks about being Japanese can go to. And when you look at black communities around the country, we no longer have that. And so we have to take the onus away from individuals and say, we have to actually create that safe space where we can have that kind of interaction, because the amount of brain power that we can bring to bear just in this room is awesome, but we have to be able to put people together on a frequent basis and have some specific goals about what we want to do. And so that's what gives me a lot of hope, because when I look at LinkedIn or something like that, I'm looking for African-American medical researchers, and there's people coming out of woodwork doing all kinds of incredible things, and they don't know each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so the more that we, that's why our April 8th program is so important, just to bring, folks who are doing research, who are doing, advanced science together in a place, and then our Journal for Black Innovation keeps them connected all throughout the year, because I kind of got tired of doing the 50 most for the last 19 years. I kind of got tired of people calling me, "What was that guy's name to you?" It's like, no, okay, we're going to do a publication.
So you can keep track of what people are doing throughout the year and stay abreast. So those are the simple kinds of things. So it's not as daunting as we might think, as long as we just connect it with each other and start putting our brain power together and say, well, you know, I mean, the interesting thing about Bloomberg, who went to Tulsa last week, you know, the thing I like most, he said, well, if I was black, you know, and then he said, well, we're gonna put $70 billion. So when, you know, our African Americans who run major enterprises, who do all kinds of things, when they start looking at issues in the black community the same way that they look at what they do in their jobs, and say, okay, if somebody hired me to fix this problem, how would I deal with it? You know, and that's a lot of what we have to do.
I'm saying thank you so much for being here and giving us this journey through California history and black doctors. We really appreciate you being here. Thank you all for being here at this collaboratory. For those of you who are looking for a seat in, am I saying that, CME?
Yes, that's right.
We're looking for continuing education credits. Please fill out the survey and drop it off in the box. Make sure your name is on it. Selena Lau will contact you to make sure that you get credit for your CEUs. And keep an eye out for our email about our collaboratories that happen every month. Thank you, Dr. for being here.
Thank you.